I got into that phase where you lie to yourself that you're making progress because you're still researching, right? You're still mm-hmm. reading and you're still doing the things that you can pat yourself on the back and say, yeah, I'm making progress. You're not actually making progress. I wasn't actually making progress. So that went on for about 9 months. And then it was like, okay, I need to do this. I need to execute the plan I've already come up with. You know, but after I got that first one and kind of just, I mean, I learned more on that first deal than the previous year and a half of research, you know, combined. All the reading in the world doesn't like really teach you until you're in the trenches actually doing things.
You're listening to the Active Duty Passive Income Podcast, the number one resource for active duty veterans and their families who want to learn how to build real wealth through real estate investing. Each week, we sit down with top military real estate investors, industry experts, and leaders who share their secrets to success in the real estate game. Now, get off your ass, get motivated, and take action to make your financial freedom dreams a reality.
Before we get started with today's show, I have to let my faithful ADPI podcast family in on a little secret. For the past year, we've been hard at work trying to consolidate all of our epic resources into one community-based platform to damn near guarantee our member success. I'm proud to announce the launch of ADPI Campus, our off-Facebook, all-in-one platform dedicated to helping the military community own more of the land they swore to protect and defend. From networking to live workshops to courses, masterminds, cohorts, and even one-on-one coaching, ADPI Campus is the community for military real estate investors worldwide. Sign up for your free trial of ADPI Campus at www.adpicampus.com, where you'll get complete access to our brand new bootcamp mini course and our exclusive deal room where you can list, connect, buy, and sell deals alongside other military real estate investors. That's www.adpicampus.com to sign up now for free. Do it now before it's too late. Now, let's start the show.
Hey, what's going on, ADPI Nation? This is your host, Kevin Brenner, and this is the Active Duty Passive Income Podcast, coming back from a bit of a hiatus. For those of you watching, you might notice a weird, different background. It's because I moved out of DC. Don't tell anyone who wanted to meet me in DC. I'm not there anymore. Moved to Europe for a while, and my wife and I are kind of living that quote-unquote financial freedom dream, right? And we're in Lisbon, loving it. This is my flat. To speak all European to you, but we're loving it. And today's episode is going to be really, really cool because we're going to be talking about something completely different that we haven't really spoke about in a while. We kind of touched on it, but not really. So we're talking with Marine Corps vet Joe Roberts here. He used to fly Cobras in the Marine Corps and jumped into real estate. And we're going to share his military background, how he got to 21 doors in 20 months while he was still active duty. So like pretty much what all of y'all are trying to do, right? Get that passive income. And then how he found his niche, dug into it. We're actually going to get practical and tactical on what is land flipping and how do you set up a call center to filter leads and then source those leads to other investors, right? So it's almost kind of like a bit of wholesaling kind of vibe, but kind of all the steps that you need to do if that's something that you're really, really into. So this podcast can be jam-packed full of information. And without further ado, Joe, welcome to the show, man.
Thanks, Kevin. Great to be here.
Yeah. So let's jump right into this, dude. First of all, we were supposed to record this podcast like 3 months ago. And like you were traveling with your whole family and in the RV, and I was moving out of DC, and then like the holidays, and then blah blah blah, all this stuff. So now we got each other's attention here. But yeah, dude. So let's jump into your military background. Talk to me about not only kind of where you were in the Marine Corps, but what was that aha moment for you that you're like, yo, I don't know if I could fly for another 9 years here.
Yeah. So, like you said, Marine Corps helicopter pilot, I commissioned in 2012, moved down to Pensacola for flight school. It's where I bought my first ever house. My wife and I lived in it. We turned it into a rental property. So that was our kind of first foray into real estate, but it was just more accidental landlords, right? Mm-hmm. Bought a house and moved away. Ended up on the East Coast flying Cobras. In 2018, I deployed to Afghanistan as a forward air controller. While I was there, you know, real estate had always been kind of something I knew I wanted to get into. You know, my parents had some real estate investments, my grandparents did. So I knew it was like the thing to do. Frankly, I just had never dedicated the time to learn what I needed to do other than, you know, my accidental landlordship. While I was in Afghanistan, there was an incident. I won't get into too many of the details, but basically, you know, I realized that, you know, your time in the Marine Corps, in the military, really in any job, you can do all the right things. You can be the best. And it, ultimately, it all comes down to somebody else's decision on, you know, where your career goes and whether you're going to get a paycheck or not. And so while I was in Afghanistan, there was an incident where, you know, there was some security violations going on that myself and a couple other officers brought attention to. The brass didn't like that because it kind of shed the command in a bad light, even though we had gone through the right channels. And we were kind of blackballed because we had brought it up the chain of command. And it made me kind of, like I said, realize like, okay, I've done all the right things, but here I am and my career is at risk. And, you know, I had a wife and three kids back at home. I was like, all right, I need to make sure that I'm financially independent. And how am I going to do this? Because I don't want the ability to take care of my family to be resting in somebody else's hands going forward. And so I landed on real estate and I just kind of, you know, it's deployment. You got a lot of downtime because you don't have anything other to do else to do. So I just started reading and just devouring content and made a plan to start investing in single family and small multifamily real estate when I got back from deployment. So in 2019, that's what I did.
Yeah. Dude, that's super interesting. That what that brings up to me, that story brings up to me the difference between power and control. And as an investor, you realize this really, really quickly that it's, even in the military too, like I realized this, you know, some people call it playing the game. You know what I mean? Like, are you going to play the game? You're going to play politics? You're going to do all that stuff? But at the end of the day, there's a huge difference between power and control. And no matter your rank, you could be an O-10 and you have all the power in the world. You still don't have the control that you need because who do you answer to? You're in government. You answer to politicians and civilian leadership, right? But when you're an entrepreneur, you can build a life for yourself where you do have some limited power. Like you're not going to go on like a shooting spree and not, there's not going to be any consequences. You're not going to go crazy, right? Like you're going to go to jail, but you can have power in your business and what you do. And you can also have control in your business and decide, hey, do I want to do this or do I not want to do this? Is this the best move for me, my family, whatever you value? Like you can tie all of those together. And that's a huge, huge draw, especially in what we're realizing as ADPI and our influence continues to grow. We're realizing that the military community, it just like Joe, like, dude, just like you, man, like they have these little moments and they're like, man, like, do I really want to keep doing this or should I start the side hustle? And then for some people like you, the side hustle grows into a full-time hustle. For other people, it's just kind of a thing that goes on the side where they can exercise a little bit more control in their lives, but also is putting, you know, food on the table or passive income in their pocket or whatever you want to say. So really, really interesting that you decided to pivot there. And I want to get into that because from what I understand, dude, you kind of like you were doing all the things that our members do, right? Like, hey, I was an accidental landlord. Then I figured this is pretty cool. Let me start doing my research. Let me learn. And then from there, it's like you built the plan and you executed. You did everything that the military teaches you to do. And what was it? You did, 21 doors in 20 months or something like that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Dude, wild. Tell me, okay, 21 doors in 20 months, just to conceptualize this for people. Would you mind going into a couple numbers on these? If you have them or if you can make them up offhand, that's cool too.
Like what kind of numbers? how it breaks down?
Like total cash flow or something like that. Like you know, your average cash flow per door on these. I know they're all different shapes and sizes, so it might be different.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, as of today, right, my total port. So, I did the Burr method, which I'm sure mm-hmm. pretty of your audience is very familiar with. So, I was buying pretty crappy homes. I was sourcing deals from a large variety of places, from realtors, from Facebook Marketplace, from wholesalers, from my own direct mail campaigns, and then, you know, renovating them, you know, forcing that appreciation, refinancing them, then renting them out and repeating the process, right? So as of today, my loan to value on that portfolio is about 50%, and cash flow is right around $500 a door on average. So I had a lot of capital expenses this past year, some unexpected ones. So cash flow was not nearly that high this past year, but CapEx for the next few years should be a lot lower. So And then, you know, they're spread out across, so three markets in North Carolina. I've got one in Georgia and I've got one in Florida. So
kind of spread out
throughout the Southeast. Yep. And it's a mixture of single family and small multifamily. So I've got mostly single family, and then I've got 1 5 unit and 1 4 unit.
That's great.
So
you know, just for context sake, for our members to understand, 20 doors and, 21 doors in 20 months, and talking about, you know, on a good year, you're looking at about $10,000 a month in cash flow coming into those. And how, you know, we know it took you 20 months to do it. What was for you building this kind of this portfolio? Like, you came back, you had one door, right? While you were overseas, you came back from deployment, you built this plan. What was that initial plan? Because I know, like, when I build my investment plan, like 6 months down the road, sometimes my plan is completely changed, but I'm still moving in that right direction. It's like, but when you started, like from a getting started perspective, what was that first initial plan? Like, you come back from deployment and you're like, in 1 year, I want this.
Yeah. So the first initial plan was going to be two deals per year. So essentially one every 6 months. And I'll actually tell you, like, I got back for deployment, all jazzed up to go. And then I got a little scared, kind of stepped back into, right back into work, got busy. So I kind of dragged my feet, to be honest. And I got into that phase where you lie to yourself that you're making progress because you're still researching, right? You're still reading and you're still doing the things that you can pat yourself on the back and say, yeah, I'm making progress. You're not actually making progress. I wasn't actually making progress. So that went on for about 9 months. And then it was like, okay, I need to do this. I need to execute the plan I've already come up with because I'm just spinning my wheels here. So went and purchased a foreclosure, tiny little 2-bedroom, 1-bath, like 850 square foot home. And on that first one, so my original plan, part of the reason I had only planned to do two per year was because I was just going to do a lot of the renovations myself. That was a bad plan, but that was.
I was just about to say, how'd that go?
Yeah, so not great. That plan
always sounds so good on paper.
Like, it does. It really does.
Yes, I can, dude. You too.
I'm Andy. Yeah, exactly.
Andy.
Yeah. So I was getting up at 3 a.m. I was driving to the place. I was putting in like 2 to 3 hours of renovation work and then knocking off and heading over to the squadron for the day and then getting home in the evening. So I did that for a couple months and I was like, this is ridiculous. I'm exhausted. This renovation is taking way longer than it should. So then I just went out and found a hot contractor and he finished it in like a week and a half. And I was like, yeah, should have done that from the beginning. So
that really puts your life into context too. You're like, oh, yeah. Shit.
Yeah. But yeah, I learned. I'm pretty bullheaded. Sometimes I got to learn the hard way. So, but after I got that first one I learned more on that first deal than the previous year and a half of research, combined. All the reading in the world doesn't like really teach you until you're in the trenches actually doing things, right? And at that point, I was like, I was able to adjust my plan. I realized, I had liquidated about half of my wife and I's like life savings to do that first one. And then I somehow convinced my wife to liquidate the other half so that I could do another one, or most of it anyway. And then, so now I had kind of two pots of money to work with. So I was like, okay, I could do two at a time now.
Let me dig into that. What is that like? Because for a lot of our members who are married or have spouses, partners, this, that, and the other, like what are those conversations like? And what's the most difficult part about that conversation to, because a lot of people, that's a big objection into even getting started. It's like, well, yeah, I'm really educated on this. They've been through the analysis thing like you're talking about, and they're patting themselves on the back for reading all the books, right? But they haven't taken action. And because they're afraid that, their spouse or partner is going to be like, yo, you can't do this. And this is why. Like, what were those conversations like, Joe?
Yeah, I would say I didn't do a great job at first, but
just like actually, the home renovation.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't like, you have to, your spouse is rarely, if ever, going to be as enthused as you are about it, right? Like, you're the one that spends hours thinking, dreaming about it, reading. There's all sorts of nuance that you understand from kind of taking all that content in that's very hard to get across to them. But I think, like, what I didn't do a very good job of initially was like kind of laying out like very, very step by step, like this is the plan, this is the end goal, like this is the why, and starting with the why and then make basically like using that to enforce like, okay, this is what I want to get to, you know, financial stability, freedom, independence for the family, the ability to not work as much, the ability to not deploy all the time.
So not starting with a number. You started correct. With, you started with.
Well, no, that's how you should do it. That's not yeah. what I did.
Okay, well, let's clarify here. No, this is good. This is good.
So, no. Yeah, I'm telling you guys, just this is the way to actually do it. When I actually, it was like, hey, I want to, you know, all that, you know, all that money we've stocked away in the stock market for the last 10 years, I want to liquidate like a good chunk of that and go buy a crappy rental property in Jacksonville, North Carolina. So, you know, when you start with that, it's a lot harder for them because that's what they get focused on as opposed to like you getting focused on that end goal. And then you lay out the step-by-step plan to get there. Right. And so that is, and then the other thing is you gotta, like, you've got to talk about risk. Like, don't hide that. Don't like disregard it because, you know, in this situation, oftentimes they're the more conservative one because they don't understand it as well. So if you are kind of just kind of blow off what the potential risks are, then they're going to obviously think that like you've not thought this through. So you have to bring up what the risks are and then talk about how you're mitigating them. I mean, it's what every military member does all the time anyway, like at work, you might as well apply it to this. So it was actually a guest that you had on the show in the fall that kind of was who taught me how to kind of have those conversations with my spouse the right way. Steve Rosenberg, who became kind of Steve. A mentor of mine.
Yes. Steve's the man. So, he's the man, dude. He is.
Steve's awesome. And he sat down at the kitchen table with my wife and I, and like we had like an hour long conversation, and he was like playing like real estate mentor slash marriage counselor. And by the end, like my wife was on board, and that's what allowed me to kind of liquidate the other half of the portfolio and go all in. So
yeah.
Shout out to Steve.
Yeah, shout out to Steve, man. And he isn't he like based out of Mexico City now, like part time, or like what's his deal? Like
he's still in Houston, but I know that he does a lot of pops out of Mexico City.
Yeah. He's got like a studio out there. So for folks that don't know, I haven't listened to that episode. I don't have the number in front of me, but Steve is the United pilot, United captain turned real estate investor. And he and my brother's actually United pilot. So my brother listened to that episode and knows him, but more for the flying and less for the, you know, for the real estate side. So it was really, really cool. But yeah, Steve's a man. That episode was amazing. And that's really cool that you got him to actually kind of literally come to the table, right?
Yeah.
Well, you know, and you guys had those conversations because it's really easy. Like it you know, if I'm telling my spouse like, hey, I want to do this and this is why. And you, it's to have a third party come in who has no dog in the fight, quote unquote, to come and say, like, support you without actually directly supporting you is really powerful in just the general art of influence. You know what I mean? It's kind of like it's like when you're looking to buy something and you go right to the reviews, the testimonials, something like, hey, has this worked for other people? Yeah, like 100% it has. So, dude, that's super cool. So you started building this portfolio, Joe, and your initial plan was, you know, I come back from deployment, I'm going to do two deals a year, right? And then you kind of drug your feet for a little bit, and then you ended up pulling the trigger on one, and you learned a lot of lessons through it. And you still have that property, yes?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. At what point did this start ramping up for you? And, you know, because to do, you know, 21 doors and, you know, in less than 2 years, I mean, that's five-ish, six deals maybe? Something like that in 2 years. So you kind of went ahead of pace. When did this start ramping up?
Yeah. So it was about the same, like when I got connected with Steve and I, you know, learned a couple things there about systematizing and outsourcing, right? And I learned my lesson about not doing renovations. I started learning more lessons about the things that I didn't need to be doing, right? The things that I was paying myself to do that were not a high value task for me. So property management is another example, right? And so when I realized that, like, if I just find the right people to do all these things, and then I can just focus on the few aspects that need like the overall oversight, like I can then now money's the only issue. Because if I systematize it, It doesn't take as much, nearly as much of my time. Obviously, I'm still in the Marine Corps. I'm still deploying. I'm still doing workups. I'm obviously super busy. So I needed to find ways to essentially leverage other people and their time and their. So when I kind of realized that and the light bulb went off, it was like, okay, I can find realtors I want to partner with, property managers I want to partner with. I can find a good contractor, you know, and then now I just need to figure out the money aspect. And that was, you know, my own cash. So basically what ended up happening is I would have like three deals going at any one time. So three piles of cash, you know, I would have my personal cash. And then I raised money from some private investors, mostly family and friends that kind of saw what I did after the first few deals. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I agreed to pay a flat interest rate, basically the same interest rate I would pay.
So just some private money loans. They didn't have equity in the deal. They just had, yeah.
Nope,
so
they were just private money.
Yeah. What were you paying them? Like percent?
I think at the time I was paying like 8%.
Wow. That's a steal.
Well, it's a steal now. I mean, back then mortgages were at like, it was the same rate I was paying a hard money lender just without the points and fees and stuff. So then I also paid a hard money lender. So I had like these three piles. And so at any one time, I basically had three projects going. And then I ran up into the aspect of, okay, well, with the Burr method, you're kind of limited because you have to wait 6 months for that
seasoning period.
Yeah. For that seasoning, right? So I discovered a creative way of getting around that, whereby I would basically lend. So my LLC, I created an LLC that would basically lend me the money for the project at the minimum federal interest rate. Mm-hmm. Right. And then when I came time to refinance, I wasn't doing a cash out refinance. I was doing a rate term because I already had a mortgage on the property.
Interesting.
Because my LLC had a mortgage. So then now there's no seasoning for a rate term. So now the bank would just pay off my LLC's mortgage and I could move that money now onto the next deal.
Guys, this is huge. This is a light bulb moment for listeners right now. Because seasoning period, if you're a Burr investor, and by the way, Burr's like, I don't care what type of market you're in, you can find a Burr deal. You just can. You know, it might be outside the city if you're in a major city, but you can definitely find a Burr deal. There's so many ways to do it. But this is super cool. So Joe, on this rate term, were you then refinancing in your personal name or was it going into another LLC or how did that work?
So the property was in my personal name for these deals. Some of the properties, right. Like every deal is a little bit different, but for these ones, the property is in my personal name. My LLC owned the mortgage on the property. Okay. So they had lent, my LLC had lent me the money to purchase the property at a, you know, whatever the minimum federal required interest rate is at the time. It changes like every month or quarter. You can't lend yourself money for free. So it's got to be an interest rate. But what it would be a short-term loan. So that's how you can get a
so
rate
you weren't,
term.
You weren't, yeah, you weren't giving yourself a 30-year AMD loan.
That's how you can get into it. Exactly. That's how you get into a rate term because you're improving the loan terms by getting a longer term, you know, so I would give myself like a 12-month mortgage.
Can you deduct the interest you pay yourself for tax purposes? Is that a thing?
To be honest, I don't know. I don't think I did not do it, but I also didn't. I wasn't smart back then. I didn't have like a CPA, so I was like pretty conservative about everything how I did it. So
taxes.
I did not deduct it.
Doing it all, you're an everything man.
Yeah, bookkeeping. Yeah, bookkeeping. I've learned a lot. But yeah, so, you know, that really accelerated because I had good general contractors, so I could be in and out on the contract to the renovation part, you know, sometimes within a month or 6 weeks, even for these full gut jobs. And so that really allowed me to kind of turn the money faster and do more and more deals each year.
That's great. That's super cool. Oh, man, this is dropping a lot of nuggets here. So at what point, because this story then changes, the story changes from let's do more Burr deals to raw land. And we talked with, there's another episode, there's actually two episodes. We brought Brent Bowers on the podcast, who is an Army vet, and he started a community of raw land investors. I think they're called the Land Sharks. Super cool dude. So if you're at all interested in raw land, definitely listen to those episodes. But, you know, Joe, what was the main catalyst for you to go and say, okay, I'm done with these Burrs and this improved property, which is like what real estate technically is. It's, you know, there's property and then there's improved property. What made you go and say, no, I think I can do this better without the improved property and just take the raw land?
Yeah. So into like spring of 21, things started to just slow down. If you remember, I was like in 20, like the real estate market was kind of like, what are we doing with COVID? Kind of going up. And then in 21, it was like, boom, right? And for me, that meant I can no longer find deals because I was getting outbid on everything because I'm planning on keeping these. So I was competing with flippers who wanted to put lipstick on a pig and get a quick payday, right? So they could pay more because I've got to go in and I've got to make significant capital expenses and renovations because I want this as a long-term asset. And so every time I would go find like a perfect burr property, I was getting outbid by a flipper. And so it slowed way down. I only ended up purchasing, I think, like one in May. And then my last one was in, I think, August of 21. And then I was like, you know what? Things are kind of getting crazy here. I'm not finding deals. I'm just going to take a pause until I can figure out like what other real estate asset class I want to move into. I was at the Bigger Pockets conference that fall. I was actually a speaker there. Steve Rosenberg and I and Brandon Turner, the three of us did a talk there. And then I sat down for lunch, you know, one of the days, random people are at your table, just start talking like, yeah, what do you do? What do you do? So talking to a guy named JT Olmsted, and he says, you know, I flip vacant land. I was like, I've never heard of that before, but that kind of sounds awesome. And so we just kind of got to talking. I ended up, you know, buying him drinks later, and we just talked for probably close to 2 hours. And by the end, I was hooked. I was like, okay, a lot of this is very similar to what I was doing with single family, particularly the off market deal sourcing, because that's really the key for most vacant land investing. And I had already, you know, learned some stuff because I had sourced a few properties through my own direct mail campaigns when I was doing single family. So I was like, okay, I can shift that over to land. And I liked a lot of things about the assets. I was no longer dealing with contractors. I was no longer dealing with permitting. I was no longer dealing with banks. You know, it's a much simpler model. And then when he started talking about like the way you can get passive income with notes, I was like, well, that's even better than the passive income I'm getting from single family rentals, because passive income from single family rentals is not really that passive, even if you have a property manager, and it can fluctuate greatly. Case in point, you know, I barely made a dollar this past year on my entire rental portfolio in 23. Due to a lot of
all the CapEx. Random, yeah.
Yes, CapEx and stuff, right? So it's like, it's nice to have, but you should really be treating it like future CapEx, because, you know, CapEx can be all over the place and unexpected things, whereas a note is about as passive as it gets. So there's lots of things that appealed to me. I didn't have anything else that I wanted to get into with real estate at the moment. I had just gotten orders over to MarSoc, so I was in a pretty intense deployment workup. Yeah, high tempo workup. So I was like, okay, I need something that's kind of simpler that I can hire a VA to help me with. And so I landed on that. And I don't think I'll ever go back to single family rentals or small multifamily. I'll probably get into large apartments or some sort of commercial space at some point. But yeah, land is just, I love it as an asset class.
Hey guys, Kevin here, and I wanted to interrupt this week's podcast episode with just kind of a public service announcement. You know, I don't know if you guys know this, but we have this thing called the cohort, and we have one for commercial real estate and one for residential real estate. But the cohorts have been a smashing success as we launched them in 2023 and moving into 2024. We literally have like a wait list going right now. But if you're interested in learning how to do real estate investing alongside other like-minded, super focused people in the military community, like in our community, then you're going to want to sign up for the cohort. And the way we have it set up and that we're moving this direction with a residential cohort and a commercial cohort is the residential is going to focus on everything 1 to 4 units, whether that's buy and hold or BRRRR or short-term rentals and Airbnbs or like all of that stuff is in the residential side. And then your commercial real estate one, which is super powerful, is going to be focused on those large commercial 7-figure apartment buildings, mobile home parks, RV parks, things like that you thought you could never get involved in. But now with our brand new education on ADPI campus, which you guys know about, and combine that with our cohort and our coaches and everything coming together, it's becoming a very, very, very powerful tool. So if you're interested, in getting involved with this, what you need to do is go into ADPI Campus, log into ADPI Campus. And if you don't have it, again, go to www.adpicampus.com, sign up for free. Go in there and check out the events and just make comments. Go in and make a comment and say like, hey, when's the next cohort starting? And we'll get you hooked up. It's that simple. And we'll get you on the wait list and where you need to be. So again, if you guys are interested in taking your real estate game to the next level, seriously consider joining one of ADPI's highly coveted and exclusive cohorts, either for residential or commercial. They're all awesome. And people are getting fantastic results. So hope to see you in one of those cohorts. And until then, we shall get back to the show.
So
yeah, this is really, really cool. I love that kind of transition story in what you talk about, because there are a lot of frustrations, whether you're single family or, you know, I have small multifamily, and you know, I got a property manager and they handle it and all of that stuff, but you know, you still gotta do things. Things come up, you gotta pay for them. I mean, it just is what it is, you know. So having, like you said, it's, yeah, technically it's cash flow, but I've talked to so many investors who've been kind of taking from that cash flow and depending on that cash flow. And then something like this comes up, you know? So that's why I'm a big believer in the profit first method, where you, if you guys haven't read that book, you've probably heard me say it on this podcast, go and buy that book. It's an amazing book, but it helps you actually not only pay yourself a profit, but also reserve some of that cash flow, that residual that you're getting for CapEx, for taxes, for like whatever. So like when your accountant says that you have a $1,200 tax return due on this LLC, you're like, oh crap, you know, it's just how it works, you know? So, but yeah, that's really cool, dude. So raw land. Yeah, raw land. I'm in the same boat, dude. I think it's super, super interesting. Every time I talk to Brent about it or talk to someone like you about it, it's always like, you're right, it does have a lot of the same kind of aspects to it. But for listeners who maybe they're having an aha moment right now, or maybe they just want to learn more about raw land, can you go over the basics of it? Like why, for example, you know, let's start with super basic. Who owns raw land? Why are they selling raw land? And how are you getting in contact with them?
Yeah. So what I'll do is I'll take you through kind of like what the journey that most land investors take. And it typically starts with flipping / wholesaling. Okay. So that's how people get into raw land. No different really than wholesaling or flipping homes. Okay. You're buying the real estate under market value and you're selling it probably still under market value. And the delta there is your profit, right? So, you know, who owns raw land? Raw land is owned primarily, I mean, it's owned by a ton of different people, but primarily by older folks, okay? Older, like baby boomers is the largest generation of landholder, you know, vacant landholders in America by a large margin. And then as, you know, that generation, the silent generation are slowly dying off, that's being transferred via to heirs, you know, whether that's Gen X or millennials. Some interesting things that are differences between a lot of raw land and homes is that rarely does raw land have a mortgage on it. Okay. So that's a big difference between somebody, you know, in the wholesaling world, you're always dealing typically with banks and liens on the property and that sort of thing.
So most to acquire, it sounds like.
Correct.
There's no mortgage.
Exactly.
You don't have to go through that. You got to jump these hurdles.
Exactly. So it's you and the owner, right? Typically that's the only people that are, you know, in the deal essentially, and the only person you're negotiating with. And all you're negotiating with is, you know, how much they're going to take out of it. You know, sometimes you'll have tax liens and stuff like that. But again, it's raw land, so the taxes are typically not that high. You know, maybe a few hundred dollars a year. So, you know, I think the most I've ever seen on a tax lien was like $9,000. So nothing crazy, right? So why does somebody want to sell raw land up? Really, a wide variety of reasons. They could need the cash. A lot of them realize like, a lot of them bought land maybe with the dream of building someday, and things just, life changed. They never end up moving out of state. Whatever the reason is, they've come to the point where they realize, okay, we're not actually ever going to go build that house. So we're just paying taxes on this property that is sitting there, right? Or something comes up, you know, they've got a large medical bills. They decide, you know, I'd rather take my family on vacation than own that piece of land. And, you know, I'll offload it for $20,000. So lots of reasons why they sell. Why do they sell below market value? The same reasons somebody in the, you know, wholesaling single family home. Yes and no. I would say Yes, because land is very, very hard to value. Even land flippers oftentimes don't know what the value is because there's so few comps, right? So that's probably the most difficult thing about vacant land, is that it's not like you can't like draw a 2 mile radius and find 10 comps. You know, typically with vacant land, you might be looking at a 10 or even 15 mile radius. You're going back 12 months and maybe you've got four comps to go off of, right? So like what is the market value is very subjective. And I don't think in many cases, like it's not even, there's not a number that everybody's going to agree on. Whereas the home, like everybody, you know, can pretty much agree within, you know, maybe $5,000 or $10,000 of what that home's value is. It's pretty easy. So that's an aspect of it. You've got distress sale. That's why they want to sell below market value, because they want to get rid of it quick. And land is incredibly illiquid for the most part, right? In lots of places, it takes over a year to sell on like full market value. You're trying to get top dollar. You're probably going to be on the market an average of a year. So very few people are willing to wait a year. So they trade time for money like anybody else does in any other industry in the entire world. They, instead of making the pizza at home, they pay more to have somebody deliver the pizza. And same idea. They take less money in order to get it sold faster. And so those are, you know, and then some people just don't want the hassle of dealing with realtors or listing it or anything like that. And you come to them, you say, hey, cash offer, I'll close in 3 weeks. And that's appealing to them. So the reasons vary. The key is you need to get it at a price such that you can make money on. So yeah.
That's kind of why I was going to take this, because there's a lot of things spinning in my head right now. But you know, obviously got to make money on it. And let's talk about how you make money on it, because you alluded mm-hmm. to kind of creating a note for it. And we talked about that with Brent, where you go and like, hey, I can go and rent this land almost to hunters. Like, hey, hunters, you want to come on my property? And for X dollars a month, you can hunt here or whatever, or something like, you get, you know, whatever. Or people with RVs or campers, you can physically rent the land too. But you can also sell the land on a note, which is arguably even better, because then you're getting money every month in the form of cash flow. There's no maintenance on it. Like, that's a great thing about raw land too. Like, there's no maintenance. Like, literally a tree falls in on raw land, like, it doesn't matter. A tree falls on your house, you got big problems, you know? Like, and this might be a stupid question, do you even have insurance on raw land?
No.
Like, if
taxes are quite literally your only, or tax. if you're in an HOA, which I don't buy HOA properties, but if you buy vacant land in HOA, taxes and HOA fees that's your expenses. And taxes, like I said, are typically tiny. Like, even on huge lots, like, you know, 40, 50, 100 acre lots I buy, taxes are, you know, maybe $1,500, $1,000 for the year.
Yeah. Because it's raw, you know, it's just there. Yeah. So we found out how you know, where you go to get these deals. We're going to dig into that shortly. But on the flipping side, on, you know, who's buying these, who are your buyers? Like, why would they buy?
Yeah. So I just want to touch really quick on how to make money off raw land, because some people, you mentioned a few of them, but there's actually a lot more. And it's kind of, if you can get creative, there's lots of ways. So I will typically try to, you know, if I have a property I've purchased and I'm waiting to sell it, or in some cases I've purchased it and I have longer term plans for it, it's in the path of progress, or I'm planning on subdividing, it's going to be a long time. So some of the ways that you can make money, you can remove some of the timber from it, you can remove rock from it, you can rent it out to, these are all things I've done, rented it out to ginseng hunters. Okay. Ginseng is like it's an herb. And it's in the Appalachian Mountains of North Carolina. And people pay me a few hundred dollars to have the rights to go search my properties for ginseng. Same thing with truffles. Mm-hmm. Truffles. You can rent it. You can lease it to hunters. You can lease it to people to go fish. Some of my properties have like world-class trout streams on them. You can let people put a camper on it. So lots of ways kind of in the meantime to get income. And then, yes, on the flip side, when you sell it, you can turn that, you can either flip it for cash or you can turn it into a note and get passive income. So who's buying land? It depends on what the kind of land you're selling is, right? So I call it like rural, semi-rural vacant land, a little bit larger lots. Like, I'm typically no smaller than 3 acres, but really I live in like the 5 to 30 acre range of the kind of lots I'm looking at. I like to be within about an hour to an hour and a half, a relatively good sized metro, you know, 150 to 200K plus. And, you know, the vast majority of my buyers are people that are either, they want some elbow room, they want to move out of the city, you know, they want a homestead, they're tired of living the suburban or the urban life, or they're people looking for a place to build, you know, the family getaway, the vacation home, the cabin to go hunt on, like just kind of like the getaway. So those are, I would say, 90% of my buyers. Now, if I was flipping infill lots in a more suburban or urban area,
you'd be selling to developers.
I'd be selling to developers or builders, right? So it kind of depends. But, you know, for me, it's a lot of people that are wanting to put, you know, a personal home on it, whether that becomes their primary or their secondary kind of.
So, yeah. And let me backtrack here because that is super interesting. I want to get back to that. When we talked about value, so in real estate, we talk about often about value add. The Burr method is a value add method, right? You mentioned two things to add value potentially to raw land. You said removing timber, removing rocks. What about going and getting it, like going through the zoning process, subdividing, maybe putting utilities on, maybe putting roads on, whether gravel or whatever? Like, is that something that raw land investors do to increase the value of the property, or are they just like, nah, that's closer to development, I don't want to play with that?
Yeah. So the timber, the rocks, that's extracting value. That's you taking some sort of cash to get some sort of return, maybe to cover your taxes. What you just described there is adding value. Okay. So that's like the next stage of what most land investors do. So first they're just flipping it, and then they're like, okay, but I can make more money as opposed to just, you know, selling this piece of vacant land as is, essentially, if I go in and I start adding value. So maybe that's clearing out some brush, clearing out a home site. Maybe that's getting a septic and well permit on file with the county. Maybe that's adding a gravel driveway. And then, you know, as you get more comfortable, that adding value kind of gets more advanced, more complicated. Now maybe it's subdividing and getting it entitled, right? Rezoning it and getting it entitled, which is a fancy way of saying getting it ready to develop into some sort of typically commercial or like multifamily development, right? And there's lots of steps you got to go through with the county and everything to do that. That takes time and work, but it adds value because then you can turn around and tell a developer, hey, this thing's shovel ready, right? Or you subdivide it, you know, because land sells, unless you're talking about infill lots, land sells on a price per acre basis. Okay. So that's how you value land. So as acreage goes up, price per acre goes down, right? So, you know, 100-acre lot might be selling for $1,000 an acre, but a 10-acre lot might be selling for $3,000 or $4,000 an acre. So if I buy a 100-acre lot at $1,000 an acre, even if I pay full market value for it, and I take the time to subdivide that into 10 10-acre lots, I've just 4x'd my investment because now I can sell those 10-acre lots off at $4,000 an acre. And so that's a very common way as you get more advanced into the land flipping niche that, you know, you go from flipping to like simple value add to subdividing and like entitling, getting a development ready.
And that's where it takes a time. That's where it takes a team. That's where it takes, you know, kind of a lot of things to get done. Because going through, I can't imagine. And you got to be pretty plugged in to that county, that zoning board, as far as like, hey, this is how you do it, because every county is different. And once you get smart on that, then you can go and make that happen. But that's super cool. Going back, Joe, so you're telling me that the timber removal and the rock removal, people are paying you to do that, to take your timber?
Yeah.
They're paying you. They're like, hey, can I have some of that wood? And I really want these rocks too.
Yeah. Cool. Like I'm looking at a deal right now. Hopefully I'll have another contract this week where I'm buying it for $80,000 and it has about $100,000 worth of timber on it.
Wow.
So, and then the land itself is probably worth about 150. So I can buy it. I can immediately find a timber company to come pay me $100,000 because it's nicely aged 25-year-old pine, southern pine timber. Come strip the timber off of it, pay me $100,000 for that. And then I can go chop it up into some smaller lots. And if I do that, then it's probably 200K. And yeah, so that's as you get into bigger lots, like there's lots of options there. Same thing with rock, like nice rock that's like big boulders that they like to use in like landscaping and stuff. If you come across a property that has a lot of that, they'll pay very nicely by the ton for that. So it's a good way of like covering expenses or even covering, in this case, like the purchase price of the property with what's on the property.
And when you're buying this stuff, are you using personal finances, investor capital, bank financing? You're not putting a note on this. Is it hard money, like, or is it just straight up cash?
So it's a few different things. I just do private lending and personal capital. There are some hard money lenders out there for land, not nearly as many. No land flippers are going to get bank financing, at least none that I've ever heard of. I mean, first of all, banks almost never lend on vacant land, or they do, but it's very hard to get. And it's typically always associated with a building loan or construction loan. And which is why when we get into like selling land on seller financing, that's why that kind of whole thing exists, is because banks don't lend on land very, very often or very well. It's very hard to find a bank lending on land. So yes, private capital, private and then personal capital. But the other thing I do is basically it's wholesaling, but it's called double closing, right? So, you know, I'll get a piece of land. Particularly, I do this if I'm not super, super confident on the comps. Again, land can be hard to comp. And so I think I know what it's worth, but I don't know. So I'll get it under contract with a nice long due diligence period, maybe 4 months, and then I'll start marketing
it. 4 months? A 4 month due diligence period?
Oh, yeah.
That's longer than most.
There's a lot of land there's a lot of land investors that do 6 months.
Whoa, guys. The average time.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, that, I mean, land takes a long time to sell. Like I said, like the average time of market's a year. So 4 months is pretty easy for me to get, to be honest. Sometimes I have to drop that down to 2 or 3, but usually I drop the price as well to, you know, commiserate the reduction in risk, or the increase in risk rather. And then I'll go find a buyer. Okay. So I market it, I find a buyer, I either, you know, prove or deny my assumptions about what it was worth. And then I just come to the table and I double close. So same day that I buy it, I sell it. So my, you know, my name does go on the title. So it's, you know, I am actually purchasing it, and then I am actually selling it. It just happens all on the same day. So I wire money to the closing attorney, they wire money back. And that's what a double closing looks like. So in that case, you don't need, like, because you need the money to purchase it, but you don't need money like to sit in the land for 4 months. So with deals like that, you know, it makes it more flexible for people.
Ah, dude, that's really, really cool. Thinking about all the options here, and I mean, we're running short on time right now. I'm going to have to bring you back on the show, because I wanted to dig into the call center thing, but that's like a whole discussion on its own. And we haven't even gotten halfway to where I wanted to get on this. But dude, so talking about, let's briefly cover the note side of it. And can you share, you kind of shared like some of the numbers, that like the deal that you're currently looking at right now, but like, can you first share, before we talk about the notes, can you share, like maybe go through an example of like, hey, this is a deal I did, this is how I found the deal. Like, you know, just do a deep dive on just any land deal that comes to mind.
Perfect. Okay. So I'll just do the most recent one, because we're just closed last week. Yeah. So like I mentioned, finding financing for land is hard. It's also hard for people to buy, you know, pay cash for land. A lot of people, right? They can't pony up 80, 100K, even 50K could be difficult, and then still have money, you know, as a down payment if they, you know, want to move a mobile home onto it, or they're going to live in a camper while they save for a home, or they're going to go straight into building, whatever it may be. It can be hard to pay cash. So offering seller financing is a great way to get passive income for yourself and to get people owning land and starting to, you know, move towards home ownership. So this most recent deal was an 8-acre lot. I purchased it for 35K cash, and I sold it for 80K. I sold it with a seller financed note where they put 20K down as their down payment, and they financed it on a 30-year amortization with a 5-year term. Okay, so for viewers that don't know what that means, amortization is how long the loan is calculated for. So they're going to be making payments as if it was a 30-year mortgage,
for but five.
Term is 5 years. So at the end of 5 years, the note is due and they have a balloon payment where they have to pay me off. That could be going and getting another loan, or they've saved up enough cash to just pay me off, whatever it is, right? And so what that looks like is about $700 a month, I think, that they're going to be paying me over the course of the next 5 years, and then there'll be a balloon payment at the end. So, you know, and then the interest rate, I think on that one's like 12.5%. Okay.
So just to slow down here, you paid $35,000 for this piece of land, and they bought it for you for $80,000, but they're going to be paying you about $700 a month. So your kind of return on capital for the first 5 years on that annualized. What's 700 times? Oh, you got your calculator out too.
All right. Yeah. Okay.
So to their calculators,
the actual number. So I just pulled it up. So it was actually 13% interest, 30-year amortization, 20% down or $20,000 down payment, and their monthly payment is $663.
Okay. So, but at the end of the day, you're making 13% for 5 years, right?
Yeah.
And then you're going to get the rest of it in full. Now, what happens if they default on this? And what, you just take this land back?
Take it back and resell it.
Resell it. Yeah, and resell it. And why?
And I already have $20,000 down. You know, they already gave me the $20,000.
Yeah, that's yours. That's non-refundable. That's like yours.
Exactly.
So they're motivated to continue to pay. But like, what? Why did they buy this?
They're gonna build on it. They have two mobile homes that they're gonna move onto it initially, and then they're gonna end up building a house on it. So they'll first live in the mobile homes, and then they'll build a long term house on it. It's a nice little property. It's got a little pond on it and stuff.
Wow. And how did you find these buyers?
Facebook Marketplace.
Awesome. So you're using kind of social media or whatever to list it. So you're not like using an agent or anything like that. Like, so you don't have to pay commissions or anything like that.
On this one, I did not. I have a wide variety of disposition strategies based on the market, the property. And I do have very good land realtors in certain markets. So in those markets, I will typically just, if it's something that I'm buying, I'll just buy it and turn it over to them and not worry about it. Otherwise, I do have a VA that works for me, my dispositions VA, who is in charge of listing it on, you know, a bunch of social media sites, some land specific marketing sites. And then sometimes we'll do a flat fee MLS service. So you pay like $100 to a flat fee MLS
service. All the MLSs, yeah.
Yeah. But you're not paying a commission still, except you might pay a buyer's commission, but you're only paying at least that half, right? Yeah. Their agent. So.
Yeah. Now we're gonna have to get into the whole virtual assistant thing on the next episode. We're gonna get into the call center on the next episode, the virtual assistant thing on the next episode, because that is just super, super awesome. Because I assume your call center is your lead flow, like how you're getting leads, and then you're going and converting them, and you're negotiating with them, and then, you know, you can use, this is my assumption here, but you're using your VAs to do a lot of that front end work and kind of warm up the lead. And then maybe you have a conversation, you close them, and you guys agree on something, you get it under contract, you do your due diligence and all of that, which we're going to get into, because due diligence on raw land is completely different. Somewhat may say easier. I don't really know. I'm very curious on remote due diligence and what that looks like, because I doubt that you're walking each one of these, every acre of all of these properties. But like going on, you know, talking about that and then going through and getting, like you said, your dispositions VA is the person that helps you then list the property. And then you go and take calls and go through the whole process. They warm up the lead. They say, hey, this guy wants to buy, blah, blah, blah. And you go in and make it happen. So
yeah, I don't think we need another episode. You just explained everything.
All right,
exactly. Cool.
I'm just going to quit podcasting and just do this.
No, it's very accurate. Yeah, that's very accurate. Exactly my process. You know, I, at this point, my land business, I'm maybe giving it, you know, on a long week, maybe 10 hours, but it's usually more like 5 to 7 hours.
And what's it putting in your pocket from all the notes and everything you got going?
And so the passive income from the notes is about $8,000 a month. And then that's when that's real passive income.
That's true passive income.
And my buddy JT Olmsted, the one that got me into land flipping, he built a website called Your Land Loans, which is a payment service. So it's just literally automatic payments from my borrowers and straight into my bank account. And then in terms of like the flipping, I did just over seven figures of revenue last year at about 35-ish% margins. So
that's fantastic. And you're putting about 10 hours a week into this.
Yeah.
And you're traveling with you're the RV guy where you're taking your kids and you're traveling and you're living that life. Guys, oh man, you're my hero, bro. No, this is awesome. This is awesome because we talk about financial freedom, and even in ADPI, like in the active duty passive income community, we're active duty passive income. Like that's who we are. And we started by using real estate, but very rarely do we have people talk about raw land. Like Joe, you just shared all this information. Brent has shared information before, but most people, when they think real estate, what do you think? You think of single family homes. Maybe you think of commercial real estate, apartment buildings and all of that, which we obviously cover. But like talking raw land, that is really, really exciting. And because it's almost like you said, it is flipping. It's got a flavor of wholesaling to it, but the true passivity in raw land, dude, it's like nothing I've ever seen before, because it truly is. We're talking note investing here. Okay, so Joe, here's the deal. We have to end it here, but this is just going to be the beginning. We're going to talk about, we're going to have you back on the show, and hopefully it's not going to take another 3 months to record.
Yeah.
But it'll be me, my big head in Lisbon. Like, we're going to have all of that. And we're going to talk about the call center. We're going to talk about how you get leads. We're going to talk about the due diligence on this process, really get tactical and practical on how you do things. And, dude, you're going to be just giving back in a way that is going to be super incredible to the military community. So if you're down, man, I'm going to get you set. I'm going to get this scheduled ASAP. All right, Joe, thank you so much for carving out the time. And, yeah, it was super cool to talk to you today.
Yeah, same, Kevin. Look forward to chatting again.
Yeah, absolutely.
Another amazing episode in the books. Thanks so much to our special guest, and thank you for listening. Don't forget to tap the subscribe button now to make sure you don't miss an episode. Or head over to our website at www.activedutypassiveincome.com to grab all of our free resources and discover how you can get started on your financial freedom journey today.